Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and I have acrophobia, fear of heights. Had it all my life. Now, I've gotten much better with it as an adult, but still, given the choice, I won't go up on things if I don't have to. And that is why I have never engaged in stage diving. You know, where someone, usually a guy, gets up on the edge of the stage or stands on a speaker or the bar or whatever raised platform is available and hurls himself out over the crowd. The idea is the crowd holds you up and you get passed around before being lowered, hopefully with all your parts intact, to the ground. So, jumping off stage into the crowd, not for me. But if I'm being honest, standing in the crowd and having to hold up some beefy guy who's probably coated with sweat and quite possibly not wearing a shirt, yeah, that's not for me either. I bring it up because the on-again, off-again debate about stage diving is on again. A recent concert by the pop-punk band Joyce Manor saw the band stop in mid-song when they saw people potentially being hurt by stage divers. We'll get that story in just a bit. We'll also get live music from Field Report, the Wisconsin rock band led by Chris Porterfield. Field Report, Porterfield, get it? But before we do any of that, it's time for another segment in our occasional How to Be Smarter series.
I am too smart. S-M-R-T. I mean S-M-A-R-T.
Smarty pants. Smarty
pants. I'm smart and I want respect.
Damn it, you have to be smarter than that.
Pretty smart, huh?
Pretty smart.
About a month ago, the citizens of London looked up at the sky and saw a giant green blimp floating overhead. It was emblazoned with the unmistakable logo of a musician that you'll never hear on mainstream radio. That musician is Aphex Twin, otherwise known as Richard D. James. Last week, he released Syro, his first full album in 13 years. Now, if you're wondering why this guy deserves his own blimp, you're not alone. And that brings us to the latest in our How to Be Smarter series. Today, we're going to get smarter about the mysterious artist that is Aphex Twin. And to help us, we've called upon Simon Vozick-Levinson. He's senior editor at Rolling Stone. And Michelle Luke, who's the features editor at Thump, the electronic music channel at Vice. Simon, Michelle, welcome to Soundcheck.
Hi.
Hi.
So, Michelle, for a guy who is notoriously reclusive, Aphex Twin certainly has a thing for the big kind of gesture. What do you make of the blimp over the skies of London?
I think he's always sort of portrayed himself as sort of the merry prankster of the dance music world. He has a wicked sense of humor, and he loves doing these sort of theatrical stunts that are totally tongue-in-cheek. And I think with this blimp, as well as all of the other sort of, you know, marketing stunts that he did around the album, like having a website that you could only access through the deep web.
Right, so you needed a special bit of software to access it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And when you went on that website, you had your not only the track list for the album, but also the information from your computer printed on the website. So reflecting...
Which is a little off-putting to see
right.
all that stuff there.
Right, but he loves doing that. He loves sort of throwing you, you know, against yourself and, you know, startling people and making mm-hmm. people sort of come out of what they've been, conditioned to expect.
Now, back in August, we got the press release for this record. It was perhaps the funniest, most bizarre press release. Scratch that. There's no perhaps about it. It was the single funniest, most bizarre press release I have ever seen in many, many years of thousands of press releases. It made no sense. It devolved into random English syllables at times. So this is the first full album from Aphex Twin in 13 years. It's called Syro, S-Y-R-O. And after all the weird publicity stuff about it, here's a chance to actually hear the music. We'll be right back. That is Aphex Twin from the new album Syro, his first in 13 years. Aphex Twin, a.k.a. Richard D. James, and a piece called Mini Pops 67, which is actually kind of one of his more ascertainable titles. Certainly more pronounceable than some. Now, Simon, Michelle says, the merry prankster of the dance music world. But here we get into the specifics of who Aphex Twin is, because for a dance music guy, he's not the thumping four on the floor kind of music. I can do that, but that's not what he's really known for.
That's right. Well, you know, Richard James has worked in a multitude of different styles over the years under a multitude of different, you know, pseudonyms and fake names. But that's right. He's typically associated with the more sort of esoteric kinds of music, more cerebral music. He'll make sort of, you know, long ambient washes of sound. He'll make really, you know, twisted beats that sound like they're made by an alien from another planet. But it's right. It's not dance music that you expect to hear at a club, exactly.
And Michelle, he is somebody that, you know, even folks who haven't heard of him or heard his music, we have certainly heard his influence.
Well, what I think is really interesting about him is that even though he was gone for more than a decade, so many people who were not even alive when he was making music were so excited for his comeback. And I think that that kind of speaks to the influence that he's had in every corner of music, not just electronic music, but, you know, in R&B and hip-hop and all sorts of other genres.
Well, we'll come to the hip-hop thing, because there's a little controversy there involving Kanye West in a little bit. But so, Simon, how did Richard D. James get his start? How did he become Aphex Twin?
Well, Richard D. James started making music in the late 1980s when he was in his late teens in Cornwall in the United Kingdom. He started out as a DJ in England's rave scene, playing you know, sort of acid house and, you know, that side of electronic music at the time. And he got a reputation, sort of a local reputation, but he didn't really break out and become famous until a few years later when he started putting out singles under the name Aphex Twin and ultimately put out his first album, which was sort of a left turn into ambient music.
Right. Really called, actually, Selected Ambient Works.
That's right. And that's a classic, and I recommend, you know, anyone who wants to start learning about Aphex Twin should just, you know, really soak up and absorb that album. There's a lot to hear there.
That was my introduction to him, was that record, which would have been, what,
1992, when he was 21, yeah.
But certainly his most famous song is Window Licker, which, famous song and also a pretty notorious video that goes with it, which obviously we can't show you on the radio, but here's a little bit of the song from Aphex Twin. Aphex Twin, the song Window Licker, that was released as a single, right?
Yes, that was a single in 1999, and it's, you know, it's such a great song. You can hear the sense of humor and the way he sort of twists and distorts the beats and the vocal samples.
And the way the piece starts so abstractly, mm-hmm. you know, little blips and twitters and stuff, and then it kind of picks itself up and becomes something that for Richard D. James, or Aphex Twin, is actually danceable. And this goes back, Michelle, to where you started us off today, which was Aphex Twin is the merry prankster of the dance music world.
Right. Well, I think that his sense of playfulness comes in a perhaps more artistic sense, a little bit more cerebral. You look at a song like Window Licker and you look at the music video, which was directed by Chris Cunningham, and it's incredibly funny. There's a scene with, you know, the super famous scene where the limo pulls up, and it's probably about 30 seconds long with just a limo going by. Like, it's impossibly long.
It's like the first shot in Star Wars. Where you see the this impossibly long spaceship going over the camera.
It's exactly.
Like this limo goes on forever.
And then he comes out in this rapper costume, like, you know, just oozing money everywhere. And then he starts hollering at these girls who end up being, you know, himself.
Right, they have his head.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's funny, even if it's not like, you know, laugh out loud, like slapping on your knee funny. It's funny in a sort of, I think, more intellectual way.
So that intellect, I mean, there is, Simon, a branch of electronic music known as IDM, mm-hmm. Intelligent Dance Music.
Right, which is a label that critics invented, and which, in fact, almost every artist labeled with that hates that label. If you ask, you know, Richard E. James if he likes to be called the intelligent dance music, he would laugh at you.
Right. I think he said something like, if you say this is intelligent, then everything else is dumb, you know?
But it is. I mean, it. You know, he is doing a kind of a cerebral version. I mean, the beats are not usually 1, 2, 3, 4. They're, mm-hmm. they're break beats, you know? He's playing with time and with...
Right. Yeah,
expectation.
I mean, Richard James is a virtuoso. He's sort of always showing off. He's always doing as much as he can in any track, whether it's, you know, sort of a really quiet, subtle ambient track or a really busy, loud track. He's always showing off.
And is it always digital? Is it always electronic?
No, it's actually not. You know, this is something that he's gone through different periods in his career. There have been times where he's worked exclusively with analog instruments. There have been times when he's made his music entirely on computers. He told me recently that the only thing he uses a computer for now is to sequence tracks, you know, make a track listing after mm-hmm. the music is completely done.
So with a piece like Bucephalus Bouncing Ball, mm-hmm. you know, this is yet another side.
Right, that's a completely different side. It's this completely alien, mechanical, you know, twisted vision.
From Aphex Twin. Getting a little bit smarter today on Soundcheck about Aphex Twin. It has been 13 years since his last full album. Although, Michelle, as you pointed out earlier, even though he's been away for more than a decade, there are people now, there's like a second generation of fans of his growing up.
Right. People are extremely psyched about this.
And, you know, his influence is felt in the dance world, you know, people like Square Pusher and Daedalus, but also outside, Radiohead, mm-hmm. big fans mm-hmm. of his, and you can hear his influence in certain Radiohead songs. But you mentioned before hip-hop, so let's come back to that. How do we hear the influence of this music in hip-hop?
Well, I think that, you know, his sound has become so much a part of the pop music canon that you see his influences everywhere. But it also comes down to sort of more specific instances of sampling, where there was a super famous story that came out a while ago about how Kanye West had basically lifted a piano chord from Aphex's Twin song Avril 14th. And it's this like really beautiful sort of piano melody that I think he made using one of his robotically controlled pianos. And Kanye just sort of, you know, took it and used it as part of his song. And, you know, Aphex Twin reached out to him and wanted to give him, you know, a better quality version of uh-huh. that song. And Kanye said something like, it's not yours, it's ours. Which I think is actually very poignant in the way that people sort of view Aphex Twin's material as sort of a common commonly shared material
yeah,
now.
Yeah. Well, and this sort of gets to something, Simon, we were talking about a moment ago, which is, you know, the many sides of Aphex Twin. He told you he had a whole room full of robots.
Yeah, that's right. He claimed, and I think it's true, that he has an entire room at his house in Scotland that is just full of robots that he can program to play music.
Well, and, you know, the Yamaha Disclavier is essentially a mm-hmm. piano that plays itself. So
right.
It's kind of a robotic piano. And that's what you hear. Now, this is the original. This is Aphex Twin's original recording called Avril 14th. And now here is that same music. You'll recognize it, I think, right away in the Kanye West song, Blame Game.
Whose fault? Whose fault? Darling, Nate, Nate, I hate you more. Let's call her Nate, Nate, for sure. I'll call you for sure as a last resort and my first resort.
Pretty obvious borrowing there.
Right.
Is that the word to use?
It's sampling. I mean, I would say I actually think those are both great songs, and I actually think there's something fascinating about how Kanye recontextualized this sort of really beautiful, stately piece of music into something completely different and put a different emotional feel into it.
And kind of added a little surface noise to it. The production's really nice.
Right. I think those are both great. And I think that's actually an example of the, sort of the give and take, the creative borrowing that, is at the heart of a lot of great music.
So what happened with, there were there was more than just Richard D. James, Aphex Twin, reaching out and saying, why don't I give you a better... I mean, there were accusations maybe by people other than the two main protagonists here of theft and, some kind of illegal usage, not fair use. What's the result of this?
Well, it's not the first time that Kanye has been accused of sort of lifting other people's work. He's been sued before by other artists for the same reason, and he's usually settled out of court.
Right.
It's unclear how the situation ended between Aphex Twin and Kanye, because Kanye has refused to comment on it. And the only reason why it came out is because Aphex Twin was interviewed for a series of press rounds for his newest album, and he mentioned it. And, Aphex Twin, with his usual sort of, I don't really care air, he sort of gave the impression that he dropped it, so.
Okay.
Yeah, I will say, I did talk to him about it. He didn't seem too bothered by it. He said that, he had reached out and Kanye just sort of never got back to him. He seemed, at most, maybe mildly irked.
And at one point, Simon, in your interview for Rolling Stone with Aphex Twin, he asks you, are there many big electronic artists in America now? Is it on the radio? Is he that walled off? Does he not know?
Yeah, that was a funny question to get, because you think of someone like Aphex Twin as constantly being on the cutting edge and the forefront, but I think he leads a pretty secluded life. He said, in a tiny village outside Glasgow in Scotland. There are only 300 people in the entire town. I don't think he's spending a lot of time listening to American radio, so I think he was genuinely curious. And, when I listed some of the big electronic artists who do dominate American radio, he was, he seemed actually interested and surprised.
Right, so you named, I think, Calvin Harris. And
right, Calvin Harris, Zedd, Avicii,
Avicii,
these sort of
mega
DJs who couldn't be farther away from what Aphex Twin does, but they are electronic musicians who are massively popular.
Right, and his response was, well, that's a way in
exactly.
for people. That's the commercial stuff that gets people in, then you hope they find their way to Aphex Twin.
Right, which was a really sort of good-humored response that maybe shows that he's matured and mellowed over the years.
Well, today we've been talking about the British electronic musician known as Aphex Twin, the latest in our How to Be Smarter series. Aphex Twin, with his first full album in 13 years, released to great acclaim and some really bizarre publicity. The album is called Syro. We've been speaking with Simon Vosick-Levinson, senior editor at Rolling Stone, and Michelle Luke, features editor at Thump, the electronic music channel from Vice. And guys, thank you so much for helping us get a little smarter about Aphex Twin.
My pleasure.
When's the last time you got kicked in the head at a concert? Up next, we talk about the ethics and etiquette of stage diving, the act of leaping off a stage onto a crowd with the assumption that they'll hold you up and send you on a crowd surfing adventure. We want to hear from you. How do you feel about stage diving? You can give us a call at 866-939-1612 and stay tuned for our conversation next on Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. A lot of us are moved by music, but some of us are moved a little more than others. And when the music's loud and fast, a bold few are even moved to leave their feet entirely, leaping from the stage and floating across the heads of the crowd, which is all in good fun until someone gets kicked in the face or seriously hurt. Dan Ossie is the editor of Vice's music blog, Noisy, and he's been writing about stage diving this year, including a new piece exploring some musicians' responses to the mosh pit activity. It's titled, Is Jumping on Someone's Head Okay? Musicians weigh in on the great stage dive debate. You can find a link to it at soundcheck.org, but you can find Dan Ossie here in our Soundcheck studio. Welcome back, Dan.
Thanks for having me again.
So what is the stage dive debate and what has occasioned it now?
Well, if there is a stage dive debate, which if you ask anybody who goes to these type of shows, it's a very eye-roll-worthy debate. Nobody really wants to talk about it, but it's something that seems to be going on, and I think the band Joyce Manor sort of brought it back into the forefront because on their recent tour, they've had some, they're a very polite group of men. They're very nice guys. And they've seen on their tour just huge dudes just walloping on smaller girls and guys up front. And there's been two videos going around where they publicly called them out and said there was one that where they were rather polite about it, and then there was another where they were a bit more visceral, and so that's just sparked this whole debate of, well, is it okay to stage dive? Should the band be policing people like this? It's not new, obviously.
Right,
this is
right.
Something that Fugazi was notorious for, just stopping shows dead and giving somebody their money back and walking them out of the venue. But yeah, the Joyce Manor seems to like kicked it back up again.
Given the choice of language in the first stoppage of
right.
activity and the second, we've gone with the polite
a
one.
A smart choice for radio, yeah.
This is the pop-punk band called Joyce Manor dealing with some unwanted stage diving at their concert.
How tall are you? How much do you weigh, if you don't mind me asking?
190.
How much do you weigh? Sorry, that's really rude. You're much smaller than him, right? It's completely unacceptable for him to impose himself on top of you. Completely unacceptable, right? Under no circumstances that acceptable. Okay, thank you very much. Thank you very much. Please don't do that again. Thank you.
So that is the band Joyce Manor, Jacksonville, Florida, stopping the show because a much bigger guy has just stage-dived onto a much smaller guy. And, Dan, it seems like they've got the crowd on their side just from the reaction I'm hearing.
Right. I mean, it's such... If they were here, I'm sure that they would just, like, wonder why this is such a big debate that's being talked about on radio, because it is something stupid. But at the same time, it's like, yeah, they did have the crowd on their side because... It's regardless of being at a show, they didn't deem it appropriate. They saw somebody getting hurt regardless of the fact that it was a show or not. And it was because of their music. I'm sure that drove them nuts. Like, who wants to make the soundtrack to people getting hurt?
Right,
you know, nobody
right.
does it.
Dan Ossie's with us, editor at Noisy.com, where you have become kind of the resident expert on stage diving.
Sure.
Have you ever done it yourself?
Just because nobody... no, not really. I mean, I'm like 6 feet, like 200 pounds. I don't really need to do that. But I did it, and I'm 31 years old, and I did it really for the first time last year, which was kind of by accident, and I paid for it. So, no.
Well, that's the other thing. It's not just the people who are... being jumped on who can get hurt. You can get hurt.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
You know, diving off the stage or any table or higher thing that you can find.
People knock themselves out.
Yeah. So, but again, the sort of ancillary debate is not just whether it's okay to stage dive, but whether it's up to the band
right.
to have to be mommy and daddy. You know?
Yeah.
And so what you did, rather than just write, you know, Dan Ossie's reaction to stage diving was... To kind of poll a lot of bands.
Mm-hmm.
And what did you find?
I mean, there were obviously, like any debate, there's people on either side. Some people thought, okay, stage diving should be totally acceptable at any circumstance. People should watch out. The two sides of it are ones that say, okay, people should watch, if you're feel in danger, go to the back of the room. Mm-hmm. And then there's this other part of it where that's saying, well, that's not okay because everybody should be allowed and have the ability to stand up front if they want to. And like you're making an unsafe space for people. And it's supposed to be a punk show. Everybody's supposed to be respected.
Right.
But yeah.
And it is kind of specific to the punk and the hardcore. I mean, you don't hear people saying, oh, this is my favorite part of Beethoven's Fifth. Here I go.
Well, that's the weird thing about punk is that it is such a huge umbrella that it has all of these smaller subgenres under, and trying to come together on one philosophy is very difficult because, you know, you have like hardcore and things that are more cathartic and aggressive. Mm-hmm, and like, yeah, those people are going to, I would say, across the board be for moshing and stage diving and all that kind of stuff. But then you have like this side that Joyce Manor is more aligned with, where it's like we're trying to be more politically minded and make punk a communally respectful place. And so like we don't want people doing the dumb hardcore thing here. So it's like a hard thing to get an across-the-board solution to.
Despite which, having read the musicians' reactions to your questions to them, those that did give you a response, mm-hmm. There did seem to be a kind of consensus, which was neither it's always okay mm-hmm. or it's never okay, but that you have to be reasonable and... You know, you have to use your head.
Well, I think the voice of reason on this and in just the way that only he can, God bless him, Chris Connolly from Saves the Day, who said it best when he just said, don't be a D. And I'm censoring it, but that's the solution. Don't be a D.
Don't be a jerk.
Yeah.
Would be another way of phrasing it.
Right.
But Laura Jane Grace of the band Against Me mm-hmm. had a kind of...
Very personal,
very lengthy response. She took your question very seriously.
She did, and she responded within a half an hour, I would say, of that, and that was her response. And Laura is somebody who, it's funny because the last time I saw Against Me a couple months ago, I guess, somebody ran up on stage, this guy ran up on stage. They have a song at the end where it's notorious for people just barraging the stage and just sometimes just 25 people up there. But... yeah, so the last time I saw her, some dude, like, went up and just bear-hugged her and kissed her, and she just, like, threw the dude off the stage and kind of, like, laughed it off. But, you know, I'm sure it is annoying. If you read the story, she has a story about how her microphone literally got kicked down her throat and she broke her teeth. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it was a great essay from her.
And, you know, she is someone who has dealt with a lot of stuff
sure.
on stage, off stage, as she recounts in her transgender dysphoria blues.
She is a tough woman.
Band Against Me, led by Laura Jane Grace, and the album Transgender Dysphoria Blues, a song called Drinking with the Jocks. She had a really measured response to Dan Ozzie's question about stage diving, the great stage dive debate, the most recent round occasioned by the band Joyce Manor stopping someone from getting hurt by a rather large man diving off the stage. Dan, how closely tied is this to, you know, moshing, to, you know, I mean, we've been having this debate for 30
sure.
years since Black Flag fans began hurling themselves into each other.
Yeah, and it's not that I'm kind of in the middle of that debate that we just talked about where it's like, you know, talking about, well, what should people do? And I kind of just feel like, well, it's going to happen regardless, and it would be great if nobody ever got hurt at a show. I certainly never, ever want anybody to get hurt at a show. But, yeah, moshing, stage diving, the music does often lead to sort of aggressive ways to enjoy it.
But at least with moshing, there's a designated area.
Yeah, but that brings us back to the same debate where it's just like, okay, well, I want to just watch the show.
Right.
I should be allowed to be up front.
Yeah.
But if you think about it, that leads to a whole weird debate where it's like, okay, if stage diving and mossing is going to be up front, then like you're really just catering to your biggest Neanderthalish fans,
yeah.
And you're kind of like segregating the smaller people, and particularly women,
right.
Who take issue with this, I know. So, yeah, it's supposed to be a communal space.
Dan Ozzie's with us on Soundcheck. He's the editor at Noisy.com, and you can read his article called "Is Jumping on Someone's Head Okay? Musicians Weigh In on the Great Stage Dive Debate." It's at soundcheck.org. Soundcheck listeners, have you stage dived or been dived upon? What do you think about it? You can leave us a voicemail at 866-939-1612. That's 866-939-1612. Or leave us a comment at soundcheck.org. And also now joining us via Skype is Adam Schatz, who among the many musical arrows in his quiver is leader of the band Landlady. Hi, Adam.
Hi, John. How's it going?
Good. So give me your inside the pit perspective on this topic.
Well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take you back to the year 1997 when I was living in a suburb of Boston, Massachusetts, and I had dreams of playing rock and roll one day, and there's a big news story that hit all of the papers when at the Paradise Rock Club, the band Everclear was playing, and the New England Patriots quarterback Drew Bledsoe and the tackle Max Lane went on stage during the last song and stage dove into the crowd, and a 23-year-old Boston University student ended up getting involved in a lawsuit because she needed extensive neck and spinal surgery.
Wow.
And it all came from these two big dudes coming up on stage and throwing themselves forward. And that was kind of the first time I really thought about it, and I still associate it with that.
But Adam, she didn't just sue Drew Bledsoe and the linemen. And let's face it, football linemen, that, you know, you're talking about a huge slab of beef landing on you there. She didn't just sue them. She sued the band and the venue. I mean, Everclear got involved in this as well, right?
Sure. Well, I think, again, to go back to what you said about Beethoven, it's absolutely insane to me that anyone would be stage diving at
an Everclear show.
Concert.
Yeah.
it's truly unbelievable.
Well, but Everclear did end up, I mean, you know, they ended up being liable for, you know, a much smaller amount than the football players, but they were deemed liable. And it sort of gets us back to the question that Dan and I were discussing a few minutes ago. It was like, should the band be like policing its own concerts?
I think an audience reflects and respects the attitude of the band leaders as much as they can, which is why the Joyce Manor audience was so clearly on their side. I also think this, you know, particular instance that I remember is an example of why stage diving at its core is a super selfish act.
Right.
And even if it's built within community, and even if it's about a love of the band's music and a love of punk rock or a love of anything, when you really boil down to what's happening, you're getting on stage with the band and then you're throwing yourself onto the crowd where everyone lifts you up and passes you around, and you're the king. And anyone can justify it however they want, but having crowd surfed, it feels amazing. And also having played in bands where people get up on stage and crowd surf, I played in the band Man Man at Music Hall of Williamsburg last year.
I saw you there.
For some reason, that show was extraordinarily prone to crowd surfing. And because everyone in the band is constantly playing an instrument, there would be these moments where at least every song, someone would get up on stage and then dive into the audience, and they got greedier and greedier. And throughout the show, they would stay on stage for longer and longer. And at a certain point, it gets totally obnoxious to the band.
Frances Quinlan from the band Hopalong contributed to this. And I think she had, if you read one, I mean, everybody put in really good contributions, but if you read one contribution, you should read hers, because she's just the kindest person. And she's friends with Joyce Manor. She's actually on the cover of their album. So I think she took a personal issue with people. attacking Joyce Manor, because she had a great point, which is regardless of punk or music or Joyce Manor or anything, like, at the end of the day, that is a person, a fellow human being being trampled. If you saw somebody on the street, like, would you not pick them up? Mm-hmm. You would, or at least you should. So, like, for them to see somebody getting hurt and saying something, that's absolutely the right thing to do. And like, read her essay. It's really, and she's a terrific musician.
And good for the band Joyce Manor for stepping in when they saw someone in trouble. So you can read all of the responses to Dan Ozzie's question about stage diving in his article. Find it at soundcheck.org. Dan, good to see you again. Adam, nice talking to you as well. Guys, thanks so much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Up next, the leader of the Milwaukee band Field Report, Chris Porterfield, got his start playing with Justin Vernon, who later went on to found the band Bon Iver. They had a strong start with their self-titled debut album, and now Field Report is about to put out their second record, and we are excited to have them here with their instruments in tow to give us a bit of a preview. That's next on Soundcheck.
Captain, he was up all night, talking with the ghost. Singing with the angel while they touched his lips with coals cauterized.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Field Report is the band led by singer and songwriter Chris Porterfield. Naming his band was easy. Porterfield just broke up his last name and voila, Field Report. The hard part was leading the band around the country for the past 2 years. That sense of being on a journey and longing for home crops up in the new Field Report album called Marigolden. In fact, it crops up in this first song. Here is Field Report live on Soundcheck with a song called Home, Leave the Lights On.
Snapped like a coiled spring. You can feel the frost is coming on. We are marigolden, dropping orange and umber, just barely holding on. Just barely holding on. And now downtown's dialed up with tinsel and angels. Season sneaking up like haircuts, teased apart and tangled. We were fraying for a while, but we took it all down like garland hanging off traffic signals. Over us like waves. Long live beauty, short live pain. Lust for wonder and hunger pangs. You gotta face your fear, but not your shame. It doesn't end, it just wears away. Underneath, closer than solid ground beneath your feet, closer even now than these lips and teeth, closer now than out of reach. And the body remembers what the mind forgets, every heartbreaking cigarette. These reset bones, they might not hold, but they might yet.
Is Field Report live in the Soundcheck studio. The song is called Home, Leave the Lights On, and that will be on the new Field Report record called Marigolden, which comes out Tuesday. Field Report is Chris Porterfield on vocals and guitar, Shane Leonard on backing vocals and drums, Tom Winsek playing everything else, the guitars and the keyboards. Chris Porterfield, welcome.
Thank you so much, John.
Good to see you.
You
so,
too.
Homecoming, you know, is not an uncommon theme in songwriting.
Yeah, it's definitely a theme.
So when you guys were first starting out, Milwaukee was home. Is it still?
Yeah, I still live in Milwaukee. Yep. Yes, sir.
Okay. And have you made your peace with the life of a touring musician? Do these songs sort of capture you like maybe a year ago and now you're somewhere else?
Yeah, maybe so. You know, it's one of those jobs that continues to reveal. And there's a rhythm in it. That you can sort of just get into. Actually, John, between you and me and everybody, today's my eighth wedding anniversary.
What are you doing here?
Third in a row, I'm away from my wife.
Oh boy! All right.
Yeah, well. but we got into a rhythm of this thing, and we sort of like figured it out.
Okay.
And so now that we're getting ready to get back on the road, I've actually been at home for the last several months, and my wife was beginning to look at me like, when are you gonna go again, hon? When are you hitting the road? You know, you must be ready to work. I'm sure you are.
So that line in the song you just sang, the body remembers what the mind forgets.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it could talk about a couple of things. It could be about muscle memory.
Certainly.
Which, you know, certainly you don't want to have to think,
mm-hmm.
All right, how do I make my fingers do this A minor chord?
Sure,
you know,
right,
you wanna,
right.
On the other hand, that can be a very dangerous thing when you're a touring musician and you're playing gigs every night. You don't want to just be on autopilot.
Right. Oh, definitely. Definitely. And I think it just serves as even when, you know, our conscious mind isn't processing something, everything we do has consequences that we take with us.
Yeah.
And we're dragging our whole lives behind us like some kind of dredge or a tail or something, you know? And it just keeps dogging you.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the themes on this record is definitely home and displacement, and then sort of a broader idea of, well, what is home? What does it mean to be in a state of balance, in a state of well-being, and to be within that and without that at the same time? And
yeah.
So there's a lot of these themes are sort of working together.
And
absolutely.
So let's talk briefly about wordplay. I mean, Porterfield, Field Report, you know,
sure.
The been there, done that. We've talked about that before. but the word marigolden,
uh-huh.
Marigold and golden,
yeah.
That appears in the song you just sang,
yes,
in Home.
Does.
But uh-huh. Then it's also the title of yet another song, which
yeah.
You're going to do for us in a moment. So there's a kind of literal connection between some of these songs.
Definitely. Yeah, yeah. They all speak together as a piece. That word just sort of came up. I've learned as somebody who's trying to build a body of work in writing to try to be sensitive to those things when they just appear.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a word that I jotted down while we were recording this record. And I had to think on it a bit, and I came to really kind of be fond of it.
Did you know what it meant when it first popped into your head?
No, I didn't. And I had to sort of dig a bit. And so a marigold is sort of this hardy flower. It's not the prettiest thing.
Right.
It's kind of brutish. It can stand up to some inclement weather. Sometimes it kind of stinks. It's got sort of a musk about it rather than sort of a floral, perfumey thing. But every year, they die. And then if you want them again, you have to replant them.
Uh-huh.
And so that sort of began the idea of being golden, you know, being somehow chosen or anointed, juxtaposed with the idea of this sort of similarly colored thing, but is really just a very short-lived thing, huh. And is not golden at all, but in fact smells like decay even when it's thriving.
Wow. See, now when you sang the word early in the song Home, I thought, well, what a kind of spring-like metaphor. But as you describe it, it's actually more autumnal.
Definitely, yeah. One begets the other.
Right.
And so to get springtime, you have to get through those periods of decay.
Yeah.
Like there's some moments in this record where it is like, everything is falling apart.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, I believe it's a hopeful record.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that that it can be an encouragement rather than a foot on the neck kind of thing.
And I am hoping you will now do the title track for us.
It would be my pleasure. Thanks,
All
John.
Right. Chris Porterfield, the band is Field Report, and the album is called Marigolden. It comes out Tuesday, but you're getting a chance to hear some of it live here in the Soundcheck studio. Let's hear a live performance of the song Marigolden.
Now I left Nebraska in my summer dress. Left him behind there to straighten out his head. Jane was working for the airline and she bummed me up to business. She feels the thrill of every liftoff in her heart and chest. And she smelled like saffron, glowed gold and rust. Years ago I loved Jane Harmony once. But the fall fell from August and the petals all dropped off. We're always finding old lives to run away. I started to believe it. I started to believe it. Feet, I am seated by a surgeon. Said he fixed the bricks of Shah's sons who wanna be Western. Jane caught me rolling my eyes and we made up constellations. Unicorns with Roman candle horn approximations. And God came up, cautioning the wind. Jane strapped in, looked into my eyes. Now watched us fall breathless, cascading over nothing. I was feeling marigolden gliding to the ground. And I started to believe it. I started to believe it.
I started.
Once again, the band Field Report, live on Soundcheck. That is the title track of the forthcoming album, Marigolden. And that performance, once again, featuring Chris Porterfield, singing and playing guitar with Shane Leonard behind the drum kit, Tom Winsack playing keyboards, and people talk about the sophomore jinx. You know, you guys got a lot of attention on for that first round. I mean, Blind Boys of Alabama covered one of your songs.
Right, that's still pretty stunning to even think about that. Sometimes that's not the first thing you think of when you wake up in the morning and you wow, that happened. Yeah,
yeah, that really happened. So to come back, you know, stronger than ever with this second record, Marigolden, job well done.
Well, thank you so much.
It is out Tuesday, but Chris Porterfield and the rest of the band are playing some songs for us here on Soundcheck today. Chris, it's been a lot of fun. Congratulations again on the record. Thank you so much for playing for us
today. Thank you so much, John. It's a pleasure to be here.
You have a song to play us out with?
We'd be pleased to, yeah.
All right. Summons is the name of this one, and here's Chris Porterfield and Shane Leonard and Tom Winsack in the Soundcheck studio to play it for us live.
Over the water, outside of Mobile, allowing the sunset to take her time. I've been putting off the knowing in a pink and orange haze while the oil rigs are feeding me lines. And the pines straight and tall fly past looking out on 100-mile barcode prison bars. I've been whispering the Lord's Prayer over every bridge I go across. Try to summon up the strength not to swerve into the cars. But I'll be coming home. Smear it on my chest over my heart like a salve where it burns us the most. And I'll be coming home. We'll be right back.
Tomorrow on the show, punk rocker turned pop star Billy Idol can now also put author down on his resume. He's written a revealing new memoir called Dancing with Myself. The multi-platinum recording artist brings his signature lip-curling sneer to our studio. He'll discuss his uncensored and intimate account and his first new album in 10 years. Also tomorrow, the singer Samsaya blends catchy pop melodies with complex Bollywood rhythms. Her album's called Bombay Calling, and we'll get a live performance here in the studio. That's on Soundcheck tomorrow. That does it for the show today. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.